PT Final Exam is an awesome resource for students preparing to take the National Physical Therapy Exam. Choose from their Mastermind Study Group or the NPTE Home Study Bundle. Visit them online at ptfinalexam.com/pintcast.
This is the PT Pintcast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer. Bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pintcast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
All right, the next episode of the PT Pintcast starts right now, episode 81. Thanks for tuning in and listening, spreading the word via social media, online at PT Pintcast. The best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. On the show today, an assistant professor of physical therapy and co-director of the Manual Therapy Fellowship Program at Duke University Medical Center. He's got more than 20 years of clinical experience in assessment, rehabilitation, and training athletes. He's presented on orthopedic assessment and treatment methods nationally and internationally, and actively participates in research regarding various testing methods for orthopedic examination and intervention, along with human performance. He's written 12 book chapters, more than 40 peer-reviewed articles, and his own book on orthopedic clinical examination. He received his DPT from the MGH Institute of Health Professions and is currently pursuing his PhD. He's a manual therapy fellow through AOMT and a USA weightlifting coach and USA track coach, and he's the chair of the sports section hip special interest group of the APTA. Wow, how did we book this guy? He sounds busy. On the show with us, Mike Raymond. Mike, thanks for taking some time out and talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Jimmy. I'm stoked. I'm ready to go.
Let's do it. Well, hey, the first question is always the hardest on our show. What are we drinking tonight?
I am drinking 4 Foot Drop Pale Ale. It's a local North Carolina beer from Bryson City.
I like the local. I like the smaller brewers on there.
Yeah, so gotta appreciate home.
We've got a new beer store just down the street from where I live, so I got really, really excited. It's called Craft Brew, and I picked up a bunch of stuff that I hadn't had before. This one is from Flying Dog. It's called the Easy IPA. Cheers to you, Mike.
Cheers.
We embark upon another episode. So I want to thank you for something you did, and I want to make sure you get the credit for it. A while ago, about a month and a half ago, I started a fundraising endeavor to raise money for a power wheelchair for a pediatric patient that I met while on a service learning trip in Costa Rica. We announced on the show a couple episodes ago. We actually met that fundraising goal, and we're now in the process of getting that power wheelchair down to Costa Rica into that patient. And really, really early in that process, you jumped on board and said, "Hey, how can I help? What can I do?" And you gave us a copy of your book and said, "Hey, you know, here's something I did. And if somebody wants to have a shot to win this, anybody who donates has a shot to win Mike's new book, which is Orthopedic Clinical Examination." And you did that really early. You were kind of the first person who jumped on board for helping us out and said, "Hey, just how can I help?" So I want to thank you, now that we get a chance to talk face-to-face, for doing that, because that was really nice of you.
Well, I'm happy to do it. You know, I think it's great that you guys are doing that. And it's, you know, I have done that before with the other books that I've written on different topics on like that. And it seemed to be pretty positive. So I thought this would be a good option.
I got a copy of the book a while ago to take a look at. And first of all, it's heavy. I mean, this thing must have taken you a long time. Now, I've read a bunch of books. I've got a stack almost as high as me now that I'm done with PT school. I've got all my books still in my room. So you wrote a book, and you've been in physical therapy and orthopedics and been doing things like this for more than 20 years. What made you say, you know what, I'm going to be the guy to write the book? When did that come to mind?
You know, I've been teaching probably about 9 years, but I've been a clinician for over 20. And so, you know, I do have a lot of experience, but I think the biggest thing was, so I'm at Duke, and when we teach the kind of the flipped classroom is a new terminology, but it's, you know, team-based learning. I kind of got tired of just droning on in front of the class and just going over PowerPoints. And so then I started doing some voiceover PowerPoints, and it took a lot of time. So I essentially started putting my notes together and then kind of expanding on that and just more and more. And quite honestly, the biggest reason to do it was, you know, I wanted something for my kids and my family. I mean, I dedicated it to them. They've made a ton of sacrifices for me to allow me to do these kinds of things. So I wanted to leave a legacy with him.
Yeah, it must have taken some time, because if someone hasn't taken a look at this, That's what it sounds like on the podcast as it hits my desk. It's beefy, and I liked it quick, and here's the reason. I kind of lean towards the ortho direction, but that's not really why I liked this book. I like this book because you walked through things really, really easily. You laid it out really, really simply. I appreciate what you just said there about PowerPoint. I heard a really smart guy by the name of Guy Kawasaki, who's a venture capitalist, used to work for a little company called Apple, and he thinks PowerPoint is the worst creation ever because it takes some of that knowledge, that experience that you had for more than two decades out of it, but I think you put it back in a really relatable and easily digestible way, and that's how I usually like to say our podcasts are, is they're easily digestible. You can listen to them, and I'm never going to sound like the smartest guy in the room because I'm not, but I like how everything you said was intelligent but not really hard to understand.
Right, yeah, and you know, it's one of those things where in our curriculum we do MSK, and it's a four-hour class. That's hard. I mean, you know, I'm jazzed the whole time, and I'm excited. I mean, I don't have any hobbies. I mean, this is my hobby. And so this is, I mean, besides exercise and my family, just to let you know what you're dealing with here is I'm the guy that I'll take a vacation. I'll go to the beach for a week by myself. We'll start hammering out some of this book. I'm working on my PhD. So the last 2 years, I've taken a 1 week vacation at the beach by myself, and I write all day.
Wow.
And I love every second of it.
Wow. Good for you. And I mean, it shows because it comes across, like you just said, you're jazzed about every class for 4 hours as you're teaching MSK. And the pictures are really well done. And I appreciate that because I'm a visual learner, but also the explanations. I mean, you really, really simplified a lot of things that are not simple in this book. I don't like to carry a lot of books because they're heavy, but this one is something I'll keep around, and I'm not going to put it in the closet. I'm going to put it on the shelf where I can, because it really does take something. Maybe I'm not familiar with a particular pathology, or I know I've got that right there in this, and I've only had this book for about a month and a half, and I'm already kind of used to reaching for it, so I appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, and what made me kind of streamline it was feedback from my past students, and so the dedication, I do talk to them about, you know, thanks for them for all the quizzes and all the tests and all the, I tell the students day one is I want you to come up and I want you to question me, and I want you, if you don't understand something, you know, question me and or, you know, challenge me. I hate to stand in front of the class and be the only one talking. And, I mean, I just hate it. And so the reason part of getting this book to go is they're going to read stuff ahead before they come to class. And when we're in class, it's interactive. We're going over live cases. So I've written some cases for this book. And you know, on my last vacation, I wrote some more cases, and they're interactive where you can actually sit down and some of them are going to be where you can, you know, if you were going to do it, you could independently get in front of the computer, go through the case, and then it gives you multiple choice, and you choose one, and I kind of tell you if it's right or wrong, and I kind of give it a reasoning why it's right or wrong. And that's what we're going to do in class. And we have our students get in teams, and I have it set up. I haven't told them all this yet, but I have them set up to where there's going to be a race. And so it's a race, and so it's, you get points off of whether it's correct, and then you also get points off of your speed. So if you go fast and you miss a bunch, I mean, you're not going to win the race.
Well, maybe that's why I like this book so much is you wrote it from the student's perspective, and that's ultimately who's going to be consuming this book as a student.
Right.
So if you write it from an author's perspective, that's great. The information might be very, very good and correct and intelligent, but if I can't digest it easily, I'm probably not going to reach for it. So maybe that's why I like it so much, but didn't know it until you kind of explained it like that. How long did it take you to actually write? What's a process like this? Because I've heard some authors say it really has to be a labor of love. You said you only took one week vacation over the last couple of years. How long does it take from word one until you hit print?
It was awful. You know, when I got done towards the end, as I said, there's no way in heck I'm doing this again. But you know, then you take some time off, you get re-energized, and you know, I loved every minute of it. I mean, there's definitely times where, you know, can I really finish this thing? But it was years of my notes, years of editing my notes, years of having students look at my notes. You know, a lot of students have taken my notes and, you know, they put them in their own format, and I kind of looked at that. You know, really the biggest thing, kind of especially the thing in the back, the clinical orthopedics section where I'm talking about the different conditions, the different orthopedic conditions, that was kind of an idea from some of the students that I've had in the past where they, you know, it's the pathology, it's a subjective history, what's the evidence for it, it's the observation, what's the evidence for it, you know, triage. I mean, really, if you look at the majority of the books that are out there, they're special test bias based, and that's honestly, that's what students a lot of times like, and that's what we spend a lot of time in class, unfortunately, because they take so long to go over. But, right. You know, the subjective history is huge. And I've talked about this on Twitter. I've talked about this before. But, you know, it's anywhere from 75 to 90% of medical diagnoses is subjective history. Nonverbal communication, that's huge. 55 to 70%. It's extremely important.
I'm doing my my last clinical rotation right now, and I actually picked up on some of that. And I guess it's from doing these podcasts and reading what a lot of people say on Twitter, as you just mentioned, about being able to know what you're dealing with before you ever actually touch the patient. And I remember hearing that and saying, okay, but that'll come a couple years, maybe 5-6 years right. in my career. But I'm already starting to see that, being able to peek over my CI shoulder, and then I'm already able to see that when I have my own patients. And I think there's a lot of validity to what you just said about that. I really do.
I still see patients. And one big thing, I mentor in our manual therapy fellowship. And so these are typically people that have, you know, a year, 2 years, maybe 3 years of practice. And they come and they live here at Duke, and they hang out with me 3 days a week. And what we do is we've set it up for, especially when they first start, is we have them come and we have them do the subjective history. I'm sitting in there with them. I'm pretty much quiet. I don't say anything. And then we just kind of excuse ourselves from the room. And I say, okay, give me five things you think it could be and tell me why it is, why it's not, those things. Clinical reasoning is huge, extremely important. And I talk about that a lot in the book here. And so John Sylvain is the co-author of that chapter. He was one of my past fellows. And because of that, he kind of got really big and interested in clinical reasoning. You know, I had him write that chapter with me. And that's what's important. You know, we spend a lot of time doing mechanical types things in class. But really, the important thing is the reasoning. You know, that's what I like when I see patients. I see a patient on Wednesday. I come to class on Thursday. And I said, okay, guys, here's what I saw. You know, this patient was only low sensitive, going downstairs in the ankle or whatever. And I said, you know, why do you think that is? Give me some reason. It's thinking about, okay, what's the difference in weight bearing versus non-weight bearing? What's the difference in dorsiflexion versus neutral and all those kinds of things? And what could be in play?
That's cool. Yeah, I do want to highlight that a situation that you just brought up is 24 interactive case studies and 50 videos, including that last section you just mentioned. And I do appreciate that. And I know my fellow students like to see things like that. We like to be given actual cases or cases that we can think our way through. My orthopedics professor, Marwanga Blawi, sometimes wouldn't give us the answer. He would never let us know, you know, who done it in the murder mystery, because he said, look, you might get a similar patient. I don't want to bias you one way or the other. You know, his famous response was, could be. Yeah, that could be the answer. Right, could be. But he never wanted to tell us who done it in the particular case, which I didn't like then, because I wanted to know the damn answer. But I do appreciate now, because it really, you know, could be. It could be either one.
Yeah.
So you
got to
figure it out yourself. Figure it out yourself.
My famous quote is, it depends.
Right.
And I always tell the students, and I think it would probably be better for them to hear from somebody else besides myself, because, you know, they hear me all the time. But, you know, I went back to my alma mater, which is Wichita State University, and my talk was, appreciate the gray. Appreciate the gray in physical therapy. You know, the students always black and white answers, kind of like you were talking about. And I get it. I understand it. I was there too. The more you kind of get out and the more you kind of see is there's a ton of gray, and there's shades of gray, and there's shades of all kinds of colors. And that's what makes our profession so cool and so awesome. If it was black and white, if it was protocol stuff, I would be bored out of my mind. You would be bored out of your mind. You wouldn't like it.
We'd be assembly line workers, and that's not clinical reasoning at all. You bring up the color gray, and I just kind of giggled off mic, because we were introduced to that our first semester of PT school here at Marymount in Arlington by our neuro professor, when things would fall in that in between, and we wanted the black or the white. And so we as a class made an effort to, on test day, everybody wore gray. We wore gray on gray.
Oh, that's awesome.
Gray sweatpants, gray sweatshirts, because we embraced the periaqueductal gray of neuro anatomy. So I appreciate you bringing that up too. It wasn't just an isolated case of us feeling the gray.
That's awesome.
So you bring up John Sylvain. How did you pick people who co-write chapters with you? Are these just people you're friends with, or you seek out experts in areas that you wanted to include in the book?
It was a little bit of both. And so a lot of them are colleagues of mine that are directly, you know, either that were here at Duke at the time or taught with me in class. And so, you know, John Sylvain, Don Driesner, Chris Fiander, I mean, all those guys, Ben Mass, a bunch of them are now teaching at different programs. And so I knew what I was going to kind of get from them. Some of them didn't have a lot of experience writing, but, you know, they had the passion, they had the energy, that, you know, they were willing to do the work. And then I got other folks in there, like Janice Loudon.
Yeah, the chapter on gait. So tell me about that one.
She used to actually teach with me here at Duke a couple years ago, and Janice is awesome. I mean, she's a great friend of mine, and we co-taught, and she's big into gait, she's big into running. Thought she would be awesome for it. You have John DeWitt in there. He's a colleague of mine at Ohio State. I think a lot of people know John really well. Very incredible, nice guy. He's one of the really true good guys in our profession. He and I spoke several times at CSM, and good collaboration. Adrian Lowe, good colleague. Man, I used to be back in Wichita, Kansas, and Adrian was in Kansas City. I kind of knew him before he exploded into this international guy you can't hardly talk to anymore. But, and I wanted to start sprinkling a little bit of pain science in there. And I know that stuff is getting really popular now. And I wasn't really sure where it was going to go. So I thought, Adrian knows this stuff way better than I do. So start getting some of that stuff in there. And he helped me with the nervous system exam chapter. So Gib Willett, great colleague of mine at Nebraska, Mark Reinkeen, some bunch of great people.
Yeah, it sounds like a who's who list of things that you wanted to bring up in terms of topics for the book, and what better way to get kind of that all-star feel in one book? Because these people that you brought up all have different publications, whether it be books, right, or papers, but if you can reel them together, if you can bring them in and keep that consistent conversational language, well, that's a hit. That's a hit right there.
Yeah, that was actually one of the hardest parts, and I didn't realize how hard that was going to be. And so that was part of the reason I chose a lot of the colleagues that I was familiar with or that taught with me, so that they kind of knew what I was looking for. Book writing is a huge process where you submit the first submission, and then you think, okay, man, it's done. It's not even close to done. They tear it apart. They send it back to you. Okay, you got 2 weeks to send me 10 chapters back. And so, yeah, there was a lot of weekends up at the school by myself, away from my family, and my kids are in a couple of the models in there, and so my wife was there when we were shooting the video. So try to keep it as much family as possible.
Yeah, and that's also what I like, is a lot of things are going very, very interactive. I mean, as students change and types of education changes, you mentioned the flipped classroom, the books and the resources that we use, they have to change or they're going to be obsolete. So I do like the videos and the interactive case studies. That's just a sign of the times that, hey, technology and education is progressing. Let's progress with it, or no one's going to be paying attention. As you enter your 10th year of educating in PT, how have students changed now that I'm just coming to the end of my PT education career? I know we're lifelong learners and I'll learn forever.
But
formal education, how have the students changed, or what have you seen?
I have seen some changes, and I think they're very, very good and very positive. I think students are more advocates for themselves, and the fact that they're more likely to be involved, more likely, when I went through PT school, I was just trying to survive and just trying to get through. And, and it was more probably selfish, to be, if that's the right word, where, okay, I just want to get through. I want to do the best for myself, but I want to help people too. But now I think, especially at a program like Duke, where we have the team-based learning, we have it pass fail, because so then you don't have to stress out about, okay, who's top in the class, who's that kind of stuff. I mean, we purposely put people in different teams so that, the exercise science kids aren't all in the same class, so that they learn from each other. But I think that's not only in a team-based learning environment, but I think that's the PT student generally today is, they're more likely to get online, be technology savvy and those kinds of things. And like you said, is they want the interactive cases. And yes, I agree that, it depends, but I give them the interactive cases, but I make it somewhat where then we get in class and we say, okay, what would happen if, okay, so that's the answer for that particular situation. What would happen if this person was homeless? Or what would happen to this person, they didn't have a good leg, both legs were bad. And then, so that's when we get into those deeper discussions.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happens once you start going out for your clinical rotations, is there's no
right
or white. I mean, there's going to be a real live human being who's going to want some answers relatively quickly in front of you, and they're going to be presenting with stuff all over the map.
And they don't want to see a blank stare in your face, and that you're ready to cry or something. Yeah,
whatever
like that.
You do, just keep smiling and look very, very reassuring.
I tell the students every time in lab practicals, just fake it till you make it. I mean, even if you are swimming on the inside of your head, talk to your patient about anything. I mean, make them feel comfortable. Communication is extremely important. If you look at the literature, one of the big reasons why physicians get sued is because of their communication with the patient. I think there's a big, huge interaction, communication with a patient that can get you in the door, get some confidence, especially, you know, if you get introduced as a student patient. Some patients are very open to that, but some patients are not. You kind of have to win them over until you can kind of show them, okay, I do know what I'm doing.
Right. Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And over my three affiliations, I've only had two patients so far say, no, I don't want to work with this guy because he's a student. I make it a point to introduce myself as a student because I also don't want to try to pull the wool over their eyes. I don't want them to find out later and be mad at that. So I come at them pretty hard in terms of I'm a student and, you know, I've done this before. This isn't my first rodeo. It does. It conveys that confidence when you can come right at them, look them right in the eye, and they do it. Feeling that confidence in you is going to make them relax, which is a big first step in dropping that guard to being able to talk to you like a human and reveal some things you might not to a physician, especially because we have some more time with them.
I mean, we spend much more time with them, and I'm sure you've already heard this too, is patients come in. They don't really know exactly what their diagnosis is, and you know, so to speak, or even what they had done in surgery. That I get flabbergasted all the time is patients come in with a rotator cuff repair. They had the sling on. They took it off. They don't bring it. They said, "Where's your sling?" And swatted it out. I just had to wear it for a couple of days. And you know, they don't understand the importance of that kind of stuff. And so, I mean, that goes a long way.
Yeah, I had a guy yesterday who had, I'm using air quotes right now, something done to his knee surgically, and then he asked me if there was any metal in his leg, and I said, well, do you have your op report? And he said, no, and I said, well, I don't think so, but there's no way for me to definitely know, but I'm thinking, I've never had knee surgery. If I have, I'm definitely going to make sure I know exactly what's going on.
Right.
But a lot of times you get that.
And that puts you in a tough spot, too, right? And so, you know, rotator cuff repair, was it small, medium, or large? What was the tissue quality? All those things are hugely important. Luckily, you know, here at Duke, because we are extremely spoiled because everything is online. If they are a Duke patient, it goes on my chart. We can pull it up. You know, sometimes we get patients from some, you know, another physician. But, you know, I'm to the point where I'm completely spoiled, and I would feel a little bit uncomfortable without knowing, you know, those kinds of things. You know, rotator, I mean, so we always teach the students is, you know, treat it like it's a massive repair till you know, and then, you know, do those kinds of things until you're sure that it's a small or whatever it is.
Yeah, we sometimes do get spoiled about how much information we have, and then you get out there and you have something as little as that patient I had the other day, which was, I don't really know what was done. Something. He did surgery on my knee. I don't really know what it was.
Well, you know, then you have the other side of the continuum, right? So, they, you know, patients at Duke can get on, you know, their own my chart. They can get what's called my chart, and they can look up their radiography. They can look up all these kinds of things. And you know, I posted on this kind of stuff on Twitter before, but, you know, patients knowing what their radiographs say, you know, lumbar spine actually disables them more than, you know, than what their findings are. And so, you know, Modic is a radiologist that talked about this. And you know, even he himself says that sometimes it's better that patients don't know that, or at least that, you know, we present in a case that, you know what, yeah, you do have a bulging disc. So does 66% of the population.
Right. I had to bring that up with a 21-year-old female patient just yesterday in an outpatient ortho setting. And she was told, she must have been told 100 times over the last 5 or 6 years, she had a bad back. She had scoliosis, and she's going to have a spondylolisthesis when she's older because she was a gymnast and it runs in the family. And then I was checking around, and I couldn't find any evidence of scoliosis. And I just said, look, you have a back. I definitely know you have a back. And you're in physical therapy. You're in the right spot. We're going to be able to help you out. But she really, I really almost saw the look in her face kind of relax a little bit when I said, look, doesn't matter what they told you. We're going to work from here on forward. She had been just hammered home with too much information, like you said, that end of a spectrum where she was almost paralyzed. She was almost stressing herself into actually having a back problem.
Yeah, you know, I talk about this a little bit in the book, and to say, you know, and I introduce, so I do have imaging in there, and I do have the diagnostic accuracy of it and that kind of stuff, and I do put it in beginning of the, you know, I talk about the funnel approach and that kind of stuff, and so I put it kind of early in exam, because that's typically where you have access to it. But how I utilize imaging is towards the end of the examination. You know, it's after I always tell patients is, I always ask, well, so why are you here? You know, to kind of a broad opening question, and they say, well, have you seen my imaging? And I said, yeah, I have, but, let me examine you and see if that matches what's on your imaging. And so then we kind of introduce the imaging towards the end of the exam and say, you know what, you do have some bulging disc. You know, your clinical presentation doesn't seem to be near what that is showing. Let's try these things and see how it goes. And so, yeah, I had a patient similar to what you're talking about. She had a grade 3 spondy. She was in medical school, started having a little bit of back pain from sitting too long, and they diagnosed a grade 3 spondy, which she had way before sitting too long. I joke with the students, it's kind of sometimes you have to talk patients back off the cliff. stuff and saying, you know what, you're okay. This is not disabling.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, talking to him off the cliff. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we want to talk about, man, he's an educator. He's writing a book and he's getting a PhD right now. We'll get into that. We'll talk about what he's looking into in terms of some research with diagnostic imaging. On the way back with Mike Raymond on the PT Pinecast. Don't move.
We got to go pay some student loans. We'll be right back.
PT Final Exam is an awesome resource for students preparing to take the National Physical Therapy Exam. 6-week online review courses with live webinars, personal attention from instructors through email, phone, or Skype, and practice tests. Choose from their Mastermind Study Group or the NPTE Home Study Bundle. Visit them online at ptfinalexam.com/pintcast. That's ptfinalexam.com/pintcast.
We talk PT, drink beer, and record it. This is the PT Pinecast.
And we're back in the PT Pinecast with Mike Raymond, Assistant Professor of PT and Co-Director of the Manual Therapy Fellowship Program at Duke University Medical Center. You said writing a book, being an educator, a clinician, you don't have any hobbies, but I mean, I know you have to like getting up in the mountains, you got to like chilling at the beach, you got to be doing something other than all this, right? You got to unplug.
Right. You know, I do. And actually, you know, I love being in North Carolina. I grew up in the Midwest, you know, no mountains, no ocean. But being here for 5 years, the family and I spent vacations, you know, skiing in the tiny mountains here in North Carolina. You know, I love to hike. So there's nice hiking even close to my house. And I do go to the ocean with my family. I do still bring my computer. I still do write at night. But I do. Relax a little bit, but actually writing and that kind of stuff is actually relaxing for me. So, but I do have hobbies of trying to work out, hiking, and going to the beach.
Well, tell me, at least you get to watch a little bit of Duke basketball, and now Duke football making a pretty good resurgence in the ACC.
They're getting better. You know, it's, I don't know if you've ever been to Duke, but it used to be when I did my interview when we moved here and for the first 2 years is a football stadium. There's a very nice huge box over the stadium where the PT clinic is, then the physician offices was above that. The PT clinic had to be one of the most awesome clinics ever because you're actually looking over the football field and over the track that's there. Now that they're getting better, as they've torn all that down and now they have sky boxes, and so the PT clinic has moved. So
you guys got booted.
I know. It was an awesome clinic.
Well, that's got to be cool. Got to be cool to be on campus when you got teams like that to look. And just the competition coming to town too, because those teams draw some pretty good opponents too.
Oh, it's incredible. And, you know, it's what's really cool about Duke is it's actually a really small Division I university. You know, there's only 6,000 or 7,000 students. I don't know exactly what it is. There's a lot of medical students and PA students. And so that's what kind of bumps it up to about 14,000 or 15,000. But I can walk out of the back of the hospital. I can walk through, you know, where the classes are, where some of the housing is, and walk to the football stadium. And so it's, I mean, everything's right there. And it's not like Ohio State where it's huge and it's all spread out, and Ohio State, it's a great campus too, but I mean, it's very quaint. UNC is only 8 miles away. It's huge. It's spread out, and so there's a lot of closeness to
Yeah,
Duke.
definitely a different feel. I've driven through the Duke campus, and I've been on Ohio State's campus before, and yeah, they're different, but it's definitely just got a different feel.
Right.
So now you're an educator, you're a clinician, you're a writer, a little hiking in the spare time, but you're also a student going back for your PhD in diagnostic accuracy of FAI. Did I say that right? I didn't even know there was a PhD in something so specific. Tell me about that.
So I'm generally looking at fomoroacetabular impingement, or what's called FAI. Definitely an emphasis towards diagnosing it because, I don't know how much of a soapbox you want me to get on here, but in my opinion, it's a diagnosis that's overdiagnosed, and I've written a couple of commentaries and viewpoints on this, and one that's coming out here in JOSPT here pretty soon. But essentially, it comes down to is this is a diagnosis that has exploded in its prevalence and or at least popularity. You know, 18 times over, you know, 5 or 6 year period. I just think that's kind of hard to fathom that it's actually growing at that rate. So, kind of my goal is you get on Twitter or get on anywhere, and people are always arguing about, okay, what's the best treatment to do. Yeah, definitely there's some guidelines and there's those kinds of things, but my look at this is, why don't we catch these people up front and properly diagnose them, which is another reason for writing this book, is to try to, okay, what tells me it's stenosis, or what tells me it's whatever? And you know, there's definitely some argument for maybe it's not even a pathology-based kind of thing. Maybe it's a pain-based and impairment-based and that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's a whole other talk. But so my goal is to try to capture these people and try to figure out, how do I know that this is truly an FAI patient? Probably needs to go to surgery. I definitely think that there are plenty of patients that need surgery. I think that sometimes maybe it's probably not everybody that's having it done. That's kind of my goal. You know, I've written on it a little bit on in examination procedures. And essentially, when you do an exam for FAI, it's extremely sensitive. You know, it has low negative likelihood ratios. It's high in sensitivity, which means it's a screening exam, which means it has a ton of, you know, true positives, but it also has a ton of false positives, which means it then has a tendency to overdiagnose. And so that's why its specificity is really bad. You know, if you look at that, and if you look at sensitivity and likelihood ratios, which likelihood ratios are even more important, and I promise not to get too geeky statistic-wise here, but likelihood ratios are even more important than sensitivity and specificity, because they account for those people that have it versus those people that don't. What's even more important is the prevalence. So let's take two examples. So if I look at fomorostatap, so if I look at Fader's test, hip impingement test, and I look at Canadian C-spine rule, you know, Canadian C-spine rule is for a fracture in your neck. And I talk about this in the book, and I give a good analogy about this, is Canadian C-spine rules, if you look at the 2x2 tables where, you know, the true positives and all that kind of stuff, there's a lot of true positives, but there's probably three times as many false positives. So Canadian C-spine rules are designed by nature to overdiagnose something, but they're also designed not to miss a fracture. So it's better to send those people for an x-ray and them not to have the diagnosis versus saying that they don't have it and they end up doing it. In that case, it's great and it's fine to have a high sensitivity and a terrible specificity. But if you're looking at other kinds of general orthopedic kinds of things like hip impingement, there's a tendency to overdiagnose these people because they also have a lot of false positives. It becomes an issue where sometimes these people, because of that, end up going to surgery.
My research professor would be so proud because I actually just followed everything you just said.
You understood.
She would be thrilled. I was like, okay, I actually get what he's saying here. All right. No, but I get it. So you're saying really, is it becoming just kind of a catch-all term when someone doesn't know? Is it a catch-all diagnosis if there's something with the hip? We just say, you know what, it's FAI. Is it that thing now?
Well, and if you look at the literature, and I'll try not to get too deep in this, but if you look at the literature, by doing that impingement test, as we find out, you know, some of these people have, you know, other intra-articular pathology, which probably they need surgery for anyway, but some of them also have non-articular or extra-articular pathology. Maybe it's a psoas. Maybe, you know, it's some of the soft tissue that's getting impinged. You know, it's the same thing as Hawkins-Kennedy test in the shoulder. You know, it has high sensitivity, but it also has a tendency to overdiagnose. And so that's what I teach the students, is that's why you want to kind of do those highly sensitive tests early in your exam, and with the understanding that you probably are overdiagnosing some things. As you start funneling through your examination, then you can kind of start using more specific tests to kind of truly diagnose some of those pathologies.
So with your PhD, you're really just looking into the diagnostic accuracy. You're really just picking one pathology, and you're really going to get into this. And how long is this going to take you? A PhD is 5-7 years?
Yeah. It's I'm doing a European model based. And which is more based off of publications. And so I definitely still have to have, you know, the didactic schoolwork done, which I do have done at this point. And quite honestly, the reason I chose this model is because, you know, I can't afford to quit my job and go and do a full-time PhD. And the other one huge reason is because the people I'm working with. You know, I'm working with two international experts in this area. You know, it's Per Holmick and Christian Thorberg. And, you know, I thought I was pretty good at writing, and I thought those kinds of things, but usually when I send them a paper, it comes back more red than it was black. And so, but it's one of those things where you learn from that, and I've learned to be a better writer. And and I think it's always one of those things where you always want to have somebody that is smarter than you that you're working with, and you constantly need to challenge yourself. And this is what I tell the students all the time, is never get comfortable. Always be to the point where if you start feeling comfortable with something, you're going to start checking out, and you're going to start doing other kinds of things. And
and you're never going to be on top of it all the time.
Well, you mentioned publications, and you're pretty active on Twitter, so I want to make sure I pass along your Twitter handle. It's at Mike Raymond. That's M-I-K-E-R-E-I-M-A-N. You can follow him on Twitter. Just we bumped into each other at CSM not long ago in Anaheim, and you got a pretty cool experience in being able to introduce and kind of MC the big talk with Karim Khan and Jill Cook in, like, I don't know, one of the biggest rooms I'd ever been in at a PT conference. What was that like? That was a cool talk. I liked that a lot.
You know, I thought it was really good, and I loved the way, I wish CSM and other conferences would do a little bit of that. You know, if you go over to Europe, and you'll see a little bit more of that in Europe, where it's more like a debate, and I wish that we would do a bit more of that. And I think it's pretty much Twitter, but it's live. So how it kind of all came about is, you know, Karim, I published a bunch of work with him, and he liked what I did, and so he had me do some videos for Hip Exam, and so then we just kind of got to speaking, and then I said, you know what, I need to get you over to the States, and you and Joe Cook, and so I tried for 2 years to get him over, and finally got, I mean, those guys are hugely busy, and so, I mean, then they saw I was going to be in Anaheim, and I think that's probably what kind of sold it more than anything, and so sponsored by the Hip Special Interest Group from the sports section. It was great, and I liked the way they did it. You know, they kind of went in four sections. Jill talked about her concepts and those kinds of things, and then pulled the audience, okay, give me questions and those kinds of things, and Jill was kind of brutally honest, what was interesting is I didn't know what they were going to do, and Jill did not know what they were going to do. And so she went in there getting ready to talk, and she didn't know what Karim was going to do. So she handled it superbly.
Yeah, that was a cool part of CSM, and the one in Anaheim was actually my first CSM experience. I'd been to the student conclave, I've been to Next, I've been to some VPTA state meetings, and that was a really cool experience, being in a room that big with questions being fired out, and as you said, Joe Coach just being brutally honest with the answers. And I also want to make sure people know, you being the chair of the HIP Special Interest Group in the sports section, make sure that if you're involved with the APTA, you get involved with your section. It's just a little more, but I think you get a whole lot. I think it's more than the icing on the cake for a couple extra bucks. I've been a sports member for almost a year now. I made sure to get into those special interest groups, and you do get a lot out of that. Even if you're just an observer, even if you're just a voyeur on the email threads, you're getting a lot out of that if you're at all interested in the area that you happen to belong to. So I want to make sure people know about that, because as long as PT school is, it's pretty short, and I think a lot of this stuff kind of flies by. You know, I just talked to Emma Stokes. She's the president of the WCPT. I didn't even know what that was until about 2 months ago. Had no idea, and I thankfully heard the same thing after that episode aired. I heard the same thing from people who said, you know what, I had no idea that thing existed either, but it's pretty big. It's across the world, but some things can get past us.
Yeah, it is huge, and you know, that's a great point, Jimmy, is each section, at least of the sports section, you know, we try to do a monthly thing where we send out a little journal review or whatever, and it's hard to get other people to do that because, you know, people are busy, and that's a great way for students to do something is find an article, just do a journal review. I mean, it's just quick. You know, send it to me. I'll kind of help edit and that kind of stuff. But that's a good way to get involved. And I think a lot of times students are, I don't think intimidated is the right word, but I think they feel like they're not ready to go and do that. But they are ready to do that.
Early in my radio career, I realized, and only because I was kind of pushed and prompted, if you just show up and if you say, you know, I'll you know, I'm using a radio analogy, I'll clean out the prize closet. What do you need me to do? You want me to wash the station van? Right. What do you need me to do? Look, you're capable. You're more capable than you think. But I do have to say, as a student, you are in a room full of people who've been doing what you want to do and what you're studying for a long time. So you kind of feel like, oh man, I'm not going to open my mouth. I'm just going to be quiet. But I've seen by stepping forward, you do get to some insight on some stuff, and you get to meet people, which is ultimately why you go to a conference.
Right. You know, I can't tell you, you know, several students, you know, when Jill was speaking, is they said, well, can you introduce me? I said, yeah. So I went up there, but then they just hung around her for a long time. And another one of my third-year students, one of our third-year students that just graduated, went and talked to Dan Lorenz, and now she has a job with him. Wow. I mean, he's a great guy. He used to work for the Chiefs. Awesome guy. I mean, I think sometimes students feel like some people are not approachable. The majority of us are all approachable, and we want to hear from the students. And so, yeah, I mean, if you hear somebody speaking at CSM or wherever, just, you know, go up and talk to them, and just if like I'm the HIPSIG chair or sports section chair or whatever, you know, go up and talk to them. Say, hey, you know, is that okay if I write? I mean, yeah, we want the help and we need the help. Please volunteer.
Step up and show up. All right. So each episode is a pint. But before we're done with the pint, we do shots. Parting shots of wisdom. Mike just had a look on his face on Skype. He's like, wait, we're doing
parting shots.
You didn't bring shots. Parting shots of wisdom. What's something going forward as the students across the country for the class of 2016 are graduating? You're a PT educator. What's one parting shot of wisdom you can bestow upon us?
Yeah, a couple of things. So number one is appreciate the grading. We kind of already talked about that. So I think one big thing is we get a ton of Duke students that apply for residencies. Even like our first years are already asking, do I need a residency? And I'm definitely a huge fan of residencies. Duke has a ton of residencies. And I definitely think those are great things to do. But I also think that sometimes students just need some repetition, need to go out and see a few patients. And fellowships are different because typically people have a year or 2 year experience before they come in. I love to have fellows that have been out for a little bit of period of time and are struggling with some particular aspect. Because they've seen, then we can talk the language where, okay, you've seen a bunch of these, X pathologies or whatever. You've seen a bunch of people like this. And what have you done in the past? And then there's a platform there. And so as a graduate, I think it's definitely important to get a lot of repetition, subjective history, all that, the whole, entire exam, the entire treatment progression, and get good mentors. Now, good mentorship does not have to be with a residency. Now, definitely it's very advantageous to a residency. And I definitely think residencies are hugely important, and I'm a huge fan and advocate of those, but not everybody can afford to go that route. And so make sure you get in with good colleagues and make sure that you have somebody that you can bounce ideas off of, either in the clinic or you can call somebody up. I mean, I get a ton of emails from past graduate students, and I love having that. And so it's, appreciate the gray, good mentorship, and get a ton of repetition.
I like that. I am a reps guy, and I've been saying that for my 3 years of PT school. I like to see something. I'm the kind of guy, leadoff hitter. I needed to see like a bunch of pitches while I was warming up. And I also like that you say, maybe a residency isn't for everybody, because that is kind of like one of the buzz things. I mean, look, you got PT students who are pretty type A, and if you tell us that PT school is 3 years, but there's also something after that you can do. Of course, a bunch of us are going to line up and
right.
say, "Wait, do I need that? Will that help me?" So I like hearing that from you, is that, maybe it might not be right for you. Something else might be even better for you. It doesn't have to be black or white. It could be that gray for you, which is just go out and see a bunch of patients.
I always tell the students, and I'm kind of, patting on my heart here. I said, do what makes this happy, and, do what is going to make you. I have a job, but I don't feel like I have a job. I love going to work every day. I wish that every student could, and every clinician could have a situation where they go to work every day and it doesn't feel like work. And if, trust me, I've had jobs where I didn't feel like that. And eventually it wears you down. And that's what made me get back into teaching. I mean, when I graduated PT school, I thought there's no way in heck I'm going back to the classroom. Look at where I am now.
Yeah. All right. Well, check out his book. It is out now, Orthopedic Clinical Examination. And it's something to keep close. It's big. You can keep it close to you for a lot of information, but also if some sort of animal attacks you, this thing has got a lot. It's got a lot of weight to it.
You can 8 pounds.
Yeah, this thing. So you can check it out right now. We'll have some more information about the book, where you can grab it online at ptpintcast.com. Click on the blog section, and we've got a supplement to this episode on the website. So, Mike, want to thank you for taking the time out to talk to us, man.
I love it. I mean, I'm very happy that you asked me to come on this, and I really appreciate what you're doing, Jimmy, and doing these podcasts. And I think it's a good way for people just to hear other people and get good ideas. And I think it's great.
Well, thank you. I'll be hitting you up for some Duke basketball tickets pretty soon. All right.
Yeah. Good luck. I can't get them myself.
All right, Mike. Thanks a lot, man. Appreciate it.
All right. See ya.
Like what you hear? Leave us a review on iTunes. It's not like our moms can keep giving us 5 stars every day. Or can they? The PT Pintcast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.